Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Friday, May 15th was the 67th anniversary of Al-Nakba, the day that Palestinians mark as the catastrophe of Israeli occupation and which Israelis mark as simply Independence Day. Major rallies and demonstrations took place in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and by Arabs inside Israel. Palestinians living in surrounding refugee camps also commemorated Al-Nakba on Friday. In fact, more than 5 million Palestinians remain refugees, at least 1.5 million of them living in camps in Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, and other areas. It is the story of just such a Palestinian refugee boy that forms the center of a graphic novel created by my guest Leila Abdulrazak. The book is called Badawi, which is the name of a refugee camp in northern Lebanon. Leila Abdulrazak is a Chicago-based Palestinian artist and organizer, a recent graduate of DePaul University with degrees in theater arts and Arabic studies. As a student, she was active in the group Students for Justice in Palestine, where she helped to pass the DePaul divestment referendum. She's also a member of the National Students for Justice in Palestine Steering Committee, and she now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, you're incredibly young. You're only 22 years old. Tell us a little bit about your own background and how it has informed your work. I understand, do you have any formal art training?
I went to the theater school at DePaul, so my art training, if you want to call it that, is more in theater. Mm-hmm. So I don't have like visual arts training, just like whatever classes I took in high school.
Hmm. Yeah. So you're just naturally talented to put pen on paper and beautiful black on white drawings that are telling the stories of a boy loosely based on one of your relatives.
Yeah, it's the story is actually about my father, so all the stories in the book are true stories. I didn't like fabricate any of them. And a lot of them when I was starting were just little anecdotes he told us growing up, like the kinds of stories that your parents tell you over and over again and you kind of get sick of hearing them. Like, and every family has those. So that's kind of the place I started from. And then it grew from there.
So your father was born in a Palestinian refugee camp in northern Lebanon, mm-hmm. this camp called Badawi.
Yes.
Which loosely, I believe in Arabic, means Bedouin.
Yeah, it's derived from the word Bedouin, which is like a nomad or someone who lives, you know, not in one place.
So we hear a lot about the situation in Gaza. Mm-hmm. We hear a lot about the West Bank. We even hear about Palestinians living in Israel proper. We don't hear as much about mm-hmm. Palestinian refugees, but there are millions of them. How is the experience of Palestinian refugees different from Palestinians in the West Bank, Gaza, etc.?
Well, it varies from country to country, right? So, like, each country where there are Palestinian refugees, a lot of them have different rules and regulations and ways of interacting with and dealing with refugees. And the situation in Lebanon is a really particular one because in Lebanon, Palestinian refugees cannot work most jobs, you know, obviously don't have citizenship, retain their refugee status, and also cannot own land. Like, there's so many restrictions against Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, so it's almost as if, well, it is, you know, you can't participate fully in Lebanese society as a Palestinian refugee. So, it's really... It's a different kind of oppression than what you face in the West Bank and Gaza. It's kind of a dual situation because you're still suffering from you know, the Nakba and the effects of that and not being able to return to your homeland and from Israel's actions. But you're also subject to, whatever the Lebanese government or whatever the government of the host country decides to, like, inflict upon you.
Hmm. And so there are now generations of Palestinian refugees who have remained in these refugee camps for so many decades. That means that there have been children who were born, grew up as refugees, and who may have never been on Palestinian land.
Mm-hmm.
How has the concept of Palestine kind of been idealized for them through stories?
I mean, even for, like, me mm-hmm. growing up outside of, you know, I haven't obviously grown up in the camps. I've grown up in the United States and in South Korea. But, like, even for me, for anyone in diaspora, I feel like a lot of us have all these stories in our head, have stories from our grandparents, things that our families have told us. The right of return is something that's not only a right that we feel like, oh, this is something we deserve because of the law, but it's something more deeply ingrained in us from an early age. And so, like, at least speaking from my personal experience anyways, and so, like, all of these things kind of create this longing to return and this longing for justice, even on an individual level. And that's not limited to people in the camps. That's Palestinians all over the world. Right. Yeah.
Now, your book has a cover that is this image of a young boy with his back to the reader and his hands clasped behind his back is very similar to or sort of has echoes of the image that we associate today with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement of the spiky-haired, barefoot little boy who stands with his back to you. And there's a story there. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so that image is a direct reference to the work of Naji El Ali. He is a Palestinian, well, he was a Palestinian political cartoonist. And he drew, he was drawing his political cartoons at the time, during the time of and place that I was writing the book about. So he was based in Lebanon, and he was drawing cartoons about the Civil War and about the Palestinian issue. And his character, Handala, is this spiky-haired boy with his hands behind his back and his back to the reader. And this character was kind of the symbol of the Palestinian refugee child. And he appeared in all of his political cartoons with all these... He would be standing there, and all these political events would be unfolding around him.
And this little boy is just observing them.
Yeah, for the most part. For the most part, yeah.
So this, the boy in your book, the boy at the center of your book, Ahmed, based on your father, you said the stories are all real. But in the end, is he sort of a composite of the stories of you know, could he be any Palestinian refugee boy living in a camp in Lebanon?
In a sense, yeah. I think, you know, a lot of what I've heard from people is that the stories are very relatable, regardless of whether or not you grew up in the camps, or also relatable to people who had experiences like that and see some of their own stories or see some of themselves in these stories. And, you know, the stories go beyond. A lot of times when people talk about refugees, especially Palestinian refugees, the discourse gets reduced to the circumstances that those people are living in. And those circumstances, yeah, they define some parts of, you know, they can, they're the context, right? But you're still experiencing all kinds of different things that any kid would experience. It's just you're dealing with these additional burdens. Right. So, like, the first story I wrote was about my dad playing marbles in the camp and how he kind of, like, set up a way to collect more marbles from the other kids. So, like, these are stories that, like, yeah, they're framed by whatever cultural or political circumstances he was surrounded by, but there's still stories about childhood and there's still stories about his own experience.
So the stories of children interacting with one another are obviously stories that you might see anywhere in any circumstance. They're innocent, they're ordinary sort of youthfulness, but then there's this ominous backdrop of violence, of war, of dispossession. How did you draw these pictures that are based on oral history,
right?
Which is quite remarkable. Did you travel at all to the camp in Lebanon, or did you base these drawings entirely on the stories your father told you?
When I began, it was really just based on what my father was telling me. I hadn't had a lot of opportunities to go to Lebanon before. I had been a couple of times, but I hadn't spent a very long time there. The first time I went, I was 15. But when I got older, I took about 6 months to study in Lebanon. And during that time, I spent a lot of time with my family. My family still lives in the camp. And so that, like, helped me actually put more detail into the drawings and stuff like that.
Now, in your work, there are motifs that are sprinkled throughout these the panels that you draw decorated with these distinctive geometric and floral patterns. What are they? And are they, is your... you know, your effort at putting them on paper also part of your your effort to keep Palestinian culture alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So those patterns are from tatriz. It's a kind of it's traditional Palestinian embroidery, basically. It's actually
your scarf. You're wearing a scarf. Yeah. For our TV audience.
Yep. So that's what that is. But yeah, there are patterns based on that. A lot of the patterns are. There's different patterns that are specific to different areas, different geographic areas. Those patterns are passed down through families. They're taught to, you know, people will teach each other, like, how to embroider this stuff. And so it's something that's passed down from generation to generation and varies based on what region you're in. And so incorporating those motifs, yeah, it was very intentional. And it was a way, because a lot of what Israel's doing with its ethnic cleansing, it's not only physical dispossession of people from their lands or massacres or anything like that. It's also, there's a cultural component to it. And cultural... excuse me, cultural appropriation is one way that that they can kind of try to erase Palestinians. And so claiming, oh, this is Israeli embroidery. Oh, this is Israeli food. So I was very, very intentional when I was working on the book to incorporate aspects of Palestinian culture in that way, incorporate the tatriz, incorporate, you know, references to food in order to very deliberately take ownership of those aspects of our culture and remind people that, you know, we're not gone, we are still here, and these are Palestinian traditions.
Your work has been compared to Joe Sacco's Footnotes in Gaza, but honestly, I felt that it was closer to Persepolis by Marjan Satrapi, an Iranian graphic artist as well. What are your influences?
You know, I think my my biggest influence is more Naji El Ali. I looked to his work a lot when I was writing the book as kind of a window into how people were responding to events during that time period.
And this is the same artist we referred to earlier who created the character that is now become the BDF's motto or slogan.
Right, yeah. So he was a huge influence. I think there aren't many graphic novels that are very well known about Palestine, and so like, and about the Middle East in general, and so I think that's why people will jump to relate it to Sacco's work or to Satrapi's work, even though like, you know, I think those are both distinct voices, and I understand why people make the connection, but you know, we're using very different approaches to storytelling in a way. So
the storytelling that you have done, going back to some of the stories that actually have come through, the idea that there are a stateless people living in these refugee camps, talking about the right of return to a land that you know, has remained locked out, that they have remained locked out of for so many years. How are these stories being passed down generation by generation? Are they being documented in print as you have done, or are they largely being passed down orally? Is there a danger of some of this history being lost?
Yeah, I think so. And that's why it was important to me to tell this story, because it's not that my dad's story is so unique. In fact, I think a lot of, if not all, Palestinian families have incredible stories, you know, that are passed down within the family, and that within Palestinian communities we'll share these stories, and a lot of us have similar stories, but outside of that community, those stories are not as frequently told. And so it is important to write them down because, you know, as Palestinians, we don't often get a chance to write our own history. Other people write it for us, and other people kind of erase the Palestinian narrative from that a lot of the time. And so I think it's important for us to not only keep telling those stories, because it's something that all of us can do, because all of us have those stories, but also to share them with other people, because if we don't, then the Zionist narrative will continue to dominate, you know, the discourse as it has for a long time.
One of the stories that did break into the news media of the sort of conundrum facing Palestinian refugees is the recent story of a Palestinian father named Wael Al-Sali and his son, who was stranded at Dubai International Airport for 2 weeks. They were from a refugee camp in Syria and were fleeing that war. and nobody would take them. He was finally, him and his son were finally granted entry into Jordan. And it's such a sad story because while Palestinians have lost their lands, the countries that they have been temporarily resettled into are also facing wars, mm-hmm. such as what's happening in Syria, which has sort of created a double trauma for many Palestinian refugees as well. We don't hear much about what is the fate of Palestinian refugees in Syria, where there's this horrific war, mm-hmm. or in Lebanon when mm-hmm. Israel attacks Lebanon.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you can also talk about what happened on Friday, May 15th, mm-hmm. with the Al-Nakba commemoration, and give our listeners a little bit of background, because this is also something that forms a part of your story.
Right. So the Nakba, I guess you were explaining it at the beginning a little bit, but it's just Nakba Day is when we commemorate the massacres, the mass ethnic cleansing that occurred in Palestine. And my family was a part of that, was affected by that, and that's why my family went to Lebanon in the first place. So on October 30th, 1948, the Israeli army came into my family's village. They massacred, they lined up all the men. My grandfather happened to be traveling at the time. They lined up all the men in the village. They shot them and buried them in a pit. My grandmother was hiding in a building, and when my grandfather returned from his he was traveling for work. When he got back to the village, almost everyone had left because they were afraid that the Israeli army was going to come back and commit another massacre, because this was not an isolated incident. It was happening all over Palestine. And so my grandmother and my grandfather left when he returned, and they thought they didn't think they would be gone for long. They thought they would be able to come back. They left a lot of valuables there. They left everything behind. And to this day, Palestinian refugees have not been allowed to return. And my family members in Lebanon have not been able to return. My grandmother has not been able to return. My grandfather passed away a few years ago and was buried in a cemetery in our family's refugee camp. And I remember walking through the cemetery and just thinking, wow, this cemetery is full of many people who were never able to return almost 67 years later. And so that's what we commemorate the Nakba for, to remember the ethnic cleansing, and to commemorate that, and to also acknowledge that the Nakba didn't end in 1948, that it's an ongoing process, mm-hmm. that Palestinians are continually being displaced and are continually barred from re-entering mm-hmm. the country.
The Vatican recently recognized mm-hmm. the state of Palestine, and I'm wondering how much hope remains among Palestinian refugees at this moment in history, when I don't know if this is being too hopeful, but it appears as though there is a beginning of a turning point.
Yeah, you know, I can't speak for Palestinian refugees, obviously, mm-hmm. since I'm not in that situation. But, you know, I think for me, personally anyways, I feel like if we lose hope, we've lost before we can even begin. So you have to keep hope, because otherwise it's really self-defeating. But at the same time, I think the you know, that acknowledgement of the state of Palestine, you know, it's significant in that it's a symbolic move. It's mm-hmm. significant in that it's you know, it represents how times are changing. It represents how people are starting to, there's a shift in thinking, there's a shift in discourse, and that's what's interesting about it. But ultimately, it really doesn't mean much. There's still an occupation. Palestinians still haven't been allowed to return. And so, you know, people can make all kinds of statements, but at the end of the day, what it comes down to is that the occupation has to end. Palestinian refugees need to be allowed the right of return.
And so part of a possible turning point is a wave of activism on U.S. campuses that you as a student was were deeply involved in, and I'm assuming you still are. And this is the movement to encourage campuses to divest from the State of Israel, and the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement as a whole has seen some limited but some serious successes just in the past couple of years alone. Can you tell us a little bit about the activism that you engaged in at DePaul University as part of the BDS movement?
Sure. So we had a divestment campaign at DePaul. A lot of schools do a divestment resolution where they take it to the student government. At DePaul, we did things a little bit differently. We did it as a referendum. So that means that we actually put the vote to the student body and asked the student body in the student government elections. There was a question at the end of the ballot that we wrote asking people, you know, if they thought DePaul University should divest from Israeli companies that are complicit in the Israeli occupation. And we won the vote. A majority of students voted in favor of divestment. But that didn't hold the university to anything. But it was still a significant victory because we mobilized a huge number of people to actually vote in the student government elections. If I'm not mistaken, I believe it was one of the highest, if not the highest, voter turnout at DePaul University ever. We're like a commuter school, so a lot of students aren't really involved in
campus
voting.
Politics,
right,
yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it was a huge victory for us. People all over campus were, talking about it. And, it's interesting because when in history do you see an entire university campus debating what's happening in Palestine? That doesn't, that's what's unprecedented about this movement, is that it galvanizes a whole campus and gets students all over the campus really debating this this issue, which, is not very good for Israel. They kind of want to stifle that kind of critical conversation. So.
Yeah, and the fact that it has taken a hold on so many campuses, it was noticed by the New York Times, which had a very interesting article on May 9th that came under a lot of criticism. The article was entitled "Campus Debates in Israel Drive a Wedge Between Jews and Minorities." And what was really interesting about this article was that it tried to make the case that the BDS movement on U.S. campuses is pitting students of color against Jewish students. And people were quite upset because they are seeing common cause being made between Palestinian students and Black students, Palestinian students and Mexican students or Latin American students as a whole. How important is that? And even Native American students who do have, some parallels in history.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very important. That kind of solidarity is extremely powerful and it's extremely dangerous. But I think the other interesting thing about that article is that it kind of, the headline itself kind of paints Jewish students as a monolith. And there are plenty of Jewish students who have been involved in these divestment campaigns. In fact, I believe they actually interviewed a Jewish student who is involved in SJP for that article and did not quote that person.
Oh, wow.
And so...
because it would have sort of ruined the
right,
narrative.
Right, exactly. And so it's very misleading, and it's honestly insulting to anti-Zionist Jewish students who have been involved in this movement and who have put a lot into this movement.
Are you hopeful about the BDS movement taking a hold in the United States? Because, of course, the U.S. is a crucial player here. Mm-hmm. And recent months, we've seen some interesting politics here in the United States between the United States and Israel, all of which may change if there's, for example, a new Republican president, or even for that matter, if Hillary Clinton becomes president. But is there some hope, at least in terms of the U.S. narrative and action on this issue?
I mean, yeah, I think at the same time, though, we have to acknowledge that, I don't know how to explain this, the BDS movement is important and it's a central part of the overall push for Israel to end the occupation, afford the right of return, all of these things, but it's just one component of that larger struggle. But in terms of BDS taking hold in the United States, I am hopeful because of the way it's kind of exploded on campuses. And even if it's not, even if big corporations, there are some big corporations that have and some international musicians and different people who have, you know, answered the BDS call, chosen to divest, pull money out, not perform in Israel, all these different kinds of things. But even if other big corporations aren't participating right now, or universities aren't actually pulling their money out right now, I think the explosion of and success of BDS on college campuses, the effects of that are something we're going to see down the road. And so I think even if right now it seems like it's hard, I think that it definitely indicates a shift in discourse and a shift in thinking.
Leila, I want to turn back to your book, Badawi. We started the conversation talking about how young you are and that you have no formal arts training in, you know, the kind of art that one would require to put such a book together. But there's also an interesting story about how your book came about. And it's sort of a hallmark of our modern times that we're living right in today. How did your book come about? How did you get a book deal as some, you know, as a first-time artist and first-time writer of such a book?
So I originally, like I said, was just illustrating small anecdotes. And when I started, I was just publishing short anecdotes, those short anecdotes, as a webcomic in little installments. They were kind of isolated stories, and posting them on my personal blog and then to my Facebook page to share them with my friends. Mm-hmm. And eventually, those comics, people started sharing them a little bit, and someone from my publisher, Just World Books, saw them and reached out to me and said, hey, do you want to make this into a graphic novel?
Wow.
And so that's how I started doing more research into the background and kind of trying to string all the stories together into a cohesive narrative.
Well, I want to wish you the best of luck, and thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest, Leila Abdulrazak's new book is entitled Badawi, and it is just out now, available in bookstores. This is Uprising.